And now the conclusion of our discussion with Dr. Colin Ross on the CIA, mind control, and psychiatry. Please enjoy.
That's just astounding. It really is. I mean, and this is all under the auspices of national security, and everyone is toeing the line consensually through basically pop culture mind control techniques are being used to reinforce it with like shows like 24 and NCIS. I mean, every law enforcement show that people watch on TV has, they've creeped in with enhanced interrogation. Even in comedies and stuff, there it's becoming part of the dialogue to allow torture. And when I was a child growing up in the 70s, the bad guys tortured. Only the evil bad guys of enemies of America tortured, right? Americans always freed the people that were being tortured. And that was the way we were brought up to believe. And now we've shifted the role, quite apparently, into... And it's remarkable to me, as you've pointed out, even in talking to us today and in other interviews, you talk about how the most amazing thing for you intellectually was the connections between these institutions and universities and psychiatric associations and all these grandfathers of psychiatry involved at all levels of all these basically human rights violations.
Right. So it's not like the mad scientists in the basement. It's Cornell, Harvard, Yale, UCLA, Stanford, Wisconsin, Michigan, on and on and on and on. Those are the institutions that were funded at Top Secret under MKUltra. The individuals are past president of the American Psychological Association, editors of leading psychiatry journals. It's all the top dogs in the profession. It's systematic, pervasive, and it was throughout academia. And as far as I can tell, somewhere in the 70s, mid-late 70s, certainly by the early 80s, most of the contracting was shifted out of academia, which is, there's probably too much heat from the church committee hearings and so on in the 70s. And now all that mind control stuff has basically been picked up by private contractors like Sandia Labs, Psychotronics Corporation in Richmond, Virginia, and so on. And so there's still military and CIA funding in academia for sure, but I think the really high-end stuff is probably in the private sector now.
And then, of course, the irony is you just got done talking about the diagnostic manual on deviant sexuality and the various pathologies being described there. The irony is you've done a lot of work exposing within the psychiatric industry sexual abuse between doctors and patients. And again, it's remarkable to me that this engendered institutionalization of this problem is just like almost like with the Catholic Church. It seems to be kind of just sort of, let's just kind of cover that up and keep moving forward, right?
Sure. Let me give you an example of that. This is I've given one talk on this. I have a PowerPoint slide presentation, and I'm going to shortly write a paper about it. So the Salpêtrière, which is this Paris hospital that still exists, is famous in the history of psychiatry because this psychiatrist named Charcot worked there in the 19th century, and he had all these, quotes, hysterics, which were all female, and he had them all in this hospital, and they had prolonged admissions, and he studied them carefully, and they had all these hysterical symptoms and were flipping and flopping all over the place and generally being ridiculous, but he studied them. That was kind of the picture that I was presented when I was in my training. And a lot of these women had pseudo-seizures, which means they're falling down and acting as if they're having a seizure, but there's really nothing wrong with their brain. And the reason they were doing that is because they're just such hysterical comedians. They pick up any symptom around. And they were put on a unit with women who had actual epilepsy. And so that's hysteria and fake seizures. And Charcot was the famous guy who studied that. And it was all kind of silly, and it happened a long time ago in another country. That's basically the story I got. And the people who studied there included Freud and Breuer and Babinski, not Breuer, Genet and Babinski, and all kinds of famous people in late 19th, early 20th century psychiatry. And that was kind of, I always knew about that, and that's kind of a little, factoid in the history of psychiatry. Then I just read two books, which got a lot of photographs from this hospital and a lot of documentation. And lo and behold, Charcot, this famous guy, basically the hospital was a brothel and strip club, and the psychiatrists were the owners, the pimps, the Johns, all rolled into one. So these hysterical women.
And it was
women,
a hospital at the same time?
And it was a hospital, yeah.
Huh.
Because, and so it describes in the documents, this is not me like reading between the lines. It's a very clear description of Charcot's method of study of these women. Is he would be sitting at a desk, and the intern would basically bring the patient in naked. Charcot would stare at her for prolonged periods of time, and then she would exhibit various symptoms, and then the next patient, the next patient, the next patient. This was standard. There's drawings of them in labs in the hospital being given electric shocks where they're naked, and all the guys are always fully dressed. There's description of the woman's half undressed, sort of partially draped. She's having hysterical epileptic sort of attack, and he's basically pressing very hard over her ovaries and moving his hand closer and closer and closer down towards his vagina, because that kind of pressure on the ovary was supposed to stop the attack. Then it says that many of the interns had sex with the patients. It describes several patients in detail in one of the books and their sexual abuse history in great detail. And these so-called epileptic seizures that they're having, where they're just a bunch of hysterics faking that they have epilepsy, are crystal clear, very, very detailed reliving of rapes and childhood sexual abuse. And there's the words they're saying, the way they're arriving around, totally nothing but reliving of a rape. They're not faking epilepsy at all. So the cover story is, well, first of all, we don't look into all that crazy sexual activity that was going on and all these women being naked all over the place while the doctors are studying them. And we just say they're a bunch of hysterics who have faking seizures, when they weren't faking seizures at all. So there's like all these layers of cover on the real story. And when you look at then additional literature quoted in these books is describing methods used by some of the famous guys in the late 19th century going back for decades. So that included repeatedly masturbating hysterical women. The doctor would masturbate them manually to try and cure the hysteria. Having intercourse with the woman to try and cure her hysteria. And then going back, you know, a couple of hundred years to this famous doctor named Ambroise Paré, he actually invented a kind of gizmo, which was sort of like a speculum that is used in pelvic exams today, where you could open up the woman's vagina, and then they would get either very lousy smelling scents or very sweet fragrant scents and kind of send them up the woman's vagina to try and get her uterus to move around to stop her symptoms. And used all kinds of bizarre instruments. So these guys were...
All in the name of psychiatry, right, Dr. Ross?
Yeah, that was just psychiatry.
They were the ones treating these psychiatric disorders with more abuse, it sounds like.
Right. So that's the beginning of the story. And then we fast forward to the early 1980s now. And my textbook says that incest, one family out of a million, you never meet sexually abused people. In fact, there's a tsunami of sexually abused people coming through the mental health system all the time. We don't talk about sexual misconduct or sexual harassment by psychiatrists. We don't talk about family violence, none of that. And lo and behold, some studies start coming out where, not surprisingly, it's female psychiatrists start sending out questionnaires to social workers, psychologists, all types of physicians, including psychiatrists. And they fill out the questionnaire and they send it back anonymously. And they're asking, basically, have you ever been sexually involved with somebody who's currently in treatment with you? And they get back responses like with scrawling angry swear words, calling them this, that, and the other, but the questionnaire not filled out. This is all from doctors. But they basically, 10% of respondents admitted to having sex with somebody who is currently in treatment with them.
And that's just who admitted it.
That's 10% admitted.
Wow.
So that's like the lowest possible base rate in our culture.
It's just phenomenal. And so, you know, I got to ask, the question is begged at this point, how dangerous is psychiatry to humanity, Dr. Ross?
Well, so first of all, I'm going to speak as Dr. Ross, the psychiatrist, defending the profession.
Okay.
That'll take about 4 seconds. So not all psychiatrists are horrible, and not everything that all psychiatrists do is bad. And, you know, a lot of psychiatrists are basically decent people, and, you know, they're trying the best to help these very complicated problems. But psychiatry right now is totally bought into, in terms of medical schools, academia, journals, grants, the NIMH and so on, which is the National Institute of Mental Health, which is the mental health part of the National Institute of Health. All of that is totally bought into this abnormal genes, abnormal brain chemicals, abnormal symptoms model. And that then leads to medication. And I just think scientifically, clinically, in all ways, the profession as a whole is totally off track and off course. And that if you go to medical school like I did, you hear about all these rare genetic diseases. And they do exist, and people do have them, and then those people need help. But if you look at family physicians, internists, pediatricians, general surgeons, way over 95% of what doctors deal with, I would say probably over 99% of what doctors deal with is people who have no identified genetic abnormality of any kind. They don't do genetic testing on them. It's some people are taller, some are shorter. Some are more athletic, less athletic, better at math, not so good at math. But it's just, you know, normal people in the general population. And something has come in and caused them harm. It could be tobacco smoke, could be lousy food, could be HIV virus, could be a bullet, could be a knife, could be air pollution. So almost all of the work of doctors is basically a person who is more or less genetically, biologically normal, maybe a little hardier, a little less hardy. Something came in from the environment and is causing trouble. Mm-hmm. So nobody says, like, what's the gene for an ear infection? Right? So
right. That's
the actual public health reality of medicine. And if you look around the world, you know, genetic diseases are completely swamped out by lousy food, war, famine, catastrophe. That's what's causing all the disease on the planet.
And I, you know, in response to that too, I've actually thought often that the decrease in a lot of rates of disease, at least in the first world, if you want to call it that, would probably have to do more with better living conditions, sanitation, washing your hands, you know, washing your food.
Absolutely.
Not keeping animals in the house to, you know, a large degree.
Well, what we've done basically, and this is all completely proven, not disputed in regular medicine, we've basically traded diseases. So in the third world, or 150 years ago, it was all, you know, all these different kinds of infections, lack of clean water, lack of sanitation, etc. And that's still the case in the third world. So we've pretty much got a handle on most of that pretty well, not totally. But now we've traded that for cancer, cardiovascular disease, you know, heart attacks and so on.
Right.
And all these stress-related diseases. So my point about psychiatry was, if you just take a truly medical approach, then what is that going to look like in psychiatry? It's going to look like it does in medicine, which is 99% of the people we deal with don't have anything wrong with them genetically that we can identify. Definitely nothing about their genes tells us anything about treatment. It's basically regular people and bad stuff has happened to them. Mm-hmm. And the bad stuff is abuse, neglect, violence, on and on and on and on. So I just think the whole model of psychiatry is way off base. And then the investment in medications is way off base, because the medications again, this is just the science that's in the literature, not my personal opinion. The psychiatric medications really don't work very well. And like antidepressants are barely better than placebo, if at all.
I agree.
And this is in the literature, in the science, over and over and over and over and over and over. It's not a, you know, a matter that can be disputed very much. And then they have all these side effects. So psychiatrists exaggerate up how effective the meds are and minimize down how bad the side effects. And then they justify that with this, you know, brain chemical genes, so-called biological model.
And isn't it kind of like just putting a Band-Aid over a wound, not really actually getting to the root of what caused it, just kind of glossing over it so that you can get through the day with the medication as opposed to really doing the work? It's just easier to take a pill?
If the pills actually were highly effective with minimal side effects, that would be better than nothing. It's still just a Band-Aid.
True.
Nobody in psychiatry claims that any of these medications actually cure anything. They just suppress symptoms. But if they really worked well at suppressing symptoms and minimal side effects, well, that would be pretty good. But the problem is they don't. They don't work very well overall in general. The number of people who actually get a for sure benefit is tiny. And it may not be any different from placebo, or if it is different from placebo, only a little bit. And then there's all these, you know, side effects. And then all that money is diverted from looking at the social conditions, the abuse, the trauma that's causing all these problems. And
exactly.
All that money is then diverted from psychotherapy.
Yeah, so without the, you know, using the drugs to control the symptoms, not coupled with behavioral changes, is just more problem in the end. Right? I mean, you're just sort of delaying inevitable breakdown of system if you're just glossing over the symptoms and glossing over the symptoms and you're taking on board all these other side effects and other problems that then become apparent with the person. All the different, now you've got to take several medications to counteract the effects of one. And what is that kind of strain on the organs? I mean, it just gets into all kinds of, seems like to me, what you described, if you were using it to reduce the symptoms in order to do work on yourself, in order to change behavior, in order to process the trauma, in order to do those things, so it was only for a limited time you were really going to be exposed to a medicine that or a pharmaceutical that's going to help to decrease the symptoms, but always with the intention of eventually getting off the thing, correct?
Right. Now that approach totally makes sense to me, and I'm fine with that.
Yeah, I think that would actually could work for a lot of people. But the problem is that that's hard work, right? I mean, that's facing a lot of things and having to make hurdles over, you know, personal obstacles emotionally and mentally is not easy work.
Well, it's exactly the same as cardiovascular disease. So if you're 150 pounds overweight, your blood pressure is up, your glucose is up, your lipids are up. Okay, now what are you going to do about that? Well, you can either change your diet, get exercise, or you can get gastric bypass surgery. So, or you can just keep eating and die young. I mean, those are your basic options, right?
I see the point.
So
yeah.
Gastric bypass surgery, that doesn't mean sort of at a practical level, it's necessarily a bad thing, because you have to be practical. And the practical reality is there's a huge chunk of people in the United States with really bad health who are just not going to change their behavior. So since that's true, in theory, they should change their behavior, exercise more, eat better, but they're really, really, really not going to do it most of the time. So therefore, gastric bypass, they lose weight, you know, their life expectancy goes up, their disease burden goes down. That's great. Until then, you have to evaluate how often does it work, how well does it work, what are the side effects?
And also probably how well, the patient continues along with the, you know, to keep that heart healthy after that gastric bypass surgery, or they just relapse back into the negative behavior that got them there to the first place, and then they have to do it all over again. And I'd like to go back to what you'd said about about the practice and not really looking at the social issues that might be causing these
feelings in people that bring them to a place where they might need to or want to be medicated. I think that's a very important point, is that we aren't looking at, or enough looking at, the social environmental issues that would cause these things to happen.
Right. And if you challenge, say, the president of the American Psychiatric Association on that, or any like chairman of any department of psychiatry in the country, they would all go, well, yeah, of course. Everybody knows it's a combination of biological factors, social factors, and psychological factors. And that's the biopsychosocial model. And we all know that. And we've known that for a long time. And so that's true. Everybody knows that. That is the model. And everybody accepts it. But then what happens in actual reality is huge, 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 huge percentage of the funding, the prestige, the promotions, all goes to looking at what was wrong inside the person biologically, you know, on the day they were born, and how did that unfold into a mental illness. And the amount of attention and time and energy and money that goes to the social causes is really, really, really puny. So everybody, you know, has the politically correct statement and the stance on camera that, oh, yeah, we all know it's biological, psychological, and social. But then the profession doesn't really spend money on that, emphasize that, prioritize that, or publicize, you know, the social conditions aspect of it much at all.
Right. That made me think of that article that I actually had read, or not article, it was a paper that you wrote about electromagnetic fields and traditional beliefs about things. And I haven't finished the paper, but what it made me think about was that it kind of seemed like what would really help people a lot more is getting a deeper understanding of our relationship with the earth and the magnetic fields that surround us, to kind of walk barefoot again or lay in the grass again, to help promote within a better understanding of what's happening, or at least more of a deeper connection to our source, because we all come from earth, as far as I know, you know.
Yep.
Well, I'll tell you, Dr. Ross, as an unashamed conspiracy theorist, I come away from this conversation feeling less optimistic about the mainstream field of psychiatrics in all reality. I mean, I wonder, are you familiar with the work of Frank Herbert, the science fiction writer?
Is he the guy who wrote Dune?
Yes, yeah. He wrote Dune. Well, he wrote a whole, that's his, what his main book that he's known for, and the series of books he wrote around that saga. But he wrote a lot of other little 150-page sci-fi pulp novels during the 50s and 60s, probably to make ends meet, obviously. But a lot of the subjects were these teams. There was always some sort of obstacle, and there was always an embedded psychiatrist in the story. There was always an embedded psychiatrist, and he was like a double agent. He usually had some sort of extrasensory training based on like Korzybski's general semantics or something. Mm-hmm. And he was always like flagrantly like conflicted and dualistic, and he was kind of an anti-hero, you know. But I just find it remarkable in light of these ties with mind control studies and social engineering and just the things that you're talking about, that are going on, that have been a systemic issue for so long. You got to ask, you got to wonder if the deliberate ignorance of these different psychosexual traumas and conditions was almost a little bit of covering their own behinds in the agenda of knowing what was going on. Like those doctors scrawling the mad messages back to the clinicians who were trying to gather data to try to understand the big picture of things. It was like, hey, don't look there. You know, don't look behind a curtain. That's our big secret. And I wonder if is that what your thinking is as well? Is that that's why these diagnostic manuals were ignoring the what was really going on?
Well, I think it's a big puzzle with a lot of pieces, and there's not just this causes that. There's like all these different factors contributing. But so one factor is just kind of everybody doesn't want to know about it, think about it, deal with it, feel it in the whole culture. And so then we just have looking the other way, general denial, general apathy, and it's just too much trouble. And then it's too upsetting, and it's too horrifying, and who wants to go there? So that's in the culture as a whole, and therefore it's in psychiatry as a whole. And then I think we've got, well, that can't be true because my teachers never said anything about it. And if my teachers never said anything about it, but actually, in fact, childhood sexual abuse is rampant, that means my teachers didn't know what they were talking about. That means I don't know what I'm talking about. I don't want to admit that. And then there's a kind of paradigm adherence. So people intellectually, academically get very invested in their theory and their model. And if their theory and their model is there isn't that much child abuse going on, and even so it's not relevant, they're just going to resist it based on sort of paradigm model adherence. That's another part. And then there's going to be a whole bunch of people in the profession who are victims of childhood sexual abuse who don't want to talk about it, don't want to talk about it with themselves, don't want to talk about it with their spouses, don't want to talk about it with their parents, who are the perpetrators, don't want their colleagues finding out, so let's just keep a lid on the whole thing.
Right.
Then there's going to be perpetrators in the profession, which is looks like bottom line, no more, less than 10%. They don't want the lid coming off. And then when we get to the MKUltra side of things, like there's been a lot of, it's kind of parallel entangled pressure. We want to keep a lid on childhood sexual abuse, and we want to keep a lid on multiple personality disorder. So multiple personality disorder is really, really rare. It's very questionable validity. It's probably just a few kooky people who overdiagnose it, and we'll just ignore it, and it'll probably go away. And then we'll try and lobby to get it kicked out of the DSM. Well,
and yet the one actually creates the other.
Yeah.
So the one is the causality of the other. So right. There's a connection, correlation right there that's so stark.
Right. So if somebody wants to keep a lid on childhood sexual abuse and the relevance of childhood sexual abuse or physical abuse or family violence for mental health in general, they got to keep a lid on multiple personality disorder and say it's questionable reality and it's very rare and there may be the odd case and we're never going to see a case. Because the actual facts are that multiple personality disorders, about as common as bipolar disorder and schizophrenia. I just submitted a paper to a journal today, and one of the references is a paper that I did summarizing 10 studies in 6 countries where 3.9% of people in general mental hospitals, and this is just based on a fairly short research interview, were found to have previously undiagnosed multiple personality disorder, dissociative identity disorder. So it's not that rare, and it's clearly related to trauma, and regular clinicians miss it and confuse it with all kinds of other stuff. So if you really, 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 as a profession, go, oh, wait a minute, we were wrong. Multiple personality is actually not rare at all. It's part of the day-to-day assessment of people. It's driven by trauma. That's just going to, you know, that's the thin edge of the wedge. Next thing we know, a huge chunk of everything in psychiatry is driven by trauma. And then we got to redo the whole paradigm. So, you know, that's where the resistance comes in.
It's always about the paradigm. Then, support the paradigm.
And then the conspiracy angle.
Because where would it stop, you know?
Oh, yeah. And then you're just, the whole house of cards comes crumbling down. And then if you look at the False Memory Syndrome Foundation, formed in 92, you look at their board of the professional advisory board. So there's some memory people and there's some this kind of people and that kind of people. But two of the people were Martin Orn and Louis Jolyon West, who subsequently both died, who were top secret cleared Manchurian candidate program contractors under MKUltra, who also contracted with the military. And so even within the False Memory Syndrome Foundation, there's going to be multiple agendas. There's some people who like don't want trauma to be relevant. There's some people who've got some hobby horse about the way memory works. There's some people who just don't want the world talking about sexual abuse. There's some people who've been accurately accused of being pedophiles and they want a defense. And then there's going to be some people who actually, in fact, were falsely accused of childhood sexual abuse and they're innocent and they want a support group. So it's all this like hodgepodge of different motives and different people. But in there, for sure, is at least two people who would have a very, for sure, for real agenda, which is, wait a minute, these people with multiple personality are starting to get diagnosed more, and now some of them are talking to their therapists about being victims of Manchurian candidate programs. We were the contractors on the programs. We got to figure out how to put a lid on that. So we'll say it's all false memories, and we'll say it's just a bunch of crazy therapists over-diagnosing multiple personality. So part of what's been going on academically in psychiatry is the debate's been managed and shaped and funded by the military CIA trying to basically run a disinformation campaign and keep a lid on it. And that's affected me directly, personally.
Okay, so, well, that's, again, this has been a fascinating conversation. And before we run out of time with you, because I know we've got a two-hour block of your time and we really appreciate it, I wanted to kind of shift a little bit of our focus towards, in reviewing the vast body of your work, Dr. Ross, we did notice some amazing research proposals on your website for the Ross Institute, which is rossinst.com for anybody who'd like to check that out, which focuses on the power of human stare. And in fact, human awareness is the center of much of your research, as well as the concept of human energy fields. And we've already kind of mentioned it a couple times in this conversation that, you've got some other work and other areas of research. So I wonder if you could take a few moments to talk about some of the key points in this area of your work, especially with regards, as Maderex has already mentioned, to traditional beliefs in electromagnetic fields. Just to kind of put a more positive turn on this conversation before we end it, because I think that there's a lot of room for being afraid about all this stuff, but there's also solutions and stuff. And I think that some of that might be contained therein, if I'm not mistaken.
Sure. So the stuff we have been talking about, the solution is just basically to be an informed, educated, intelligent, critical consumer of information and not buy what mainstream media or the government or whoever tells you, which we've kind of covered. So if you go to my rossinst.com website, one of the buttons says Ross Energy Systems, and that's its own website, which is rossenergysystems.com. And on there, it kind of describes what I've been up to in that area, my book called Human Energy Fields. And you can go to the site called Publications. There's a button for that. And you can click on five papers that I've published in peer-reviewed journals in this area, and they pop up and you can read them. One of which is the paper that Mater X is trying to slog her way through there. So basically, there's kind of a spiritual aspect to this, a philosophical, psychological aspect, anthropological aspect, and then there's kind of a medical science aspect, which I can touch on all of them. So basically, this goes back to my personal experience, going back to when I was a teenager, and I've been thinking about it, kind of writing about it a little, but I didn't really come out of the closet on all this stuff until the last 10 years. Because I was already taking all this flack for multiple personality, I didn't want to be a whacked out person who's talking about people staring at them. So like everybody else, not everybody, but like most people, many people, I've had the experience of, I feel somebody staring at me, I just kind of sense it, I turn around and they're looking right at me, I look at them, they look at me, we exchange a look of recognition, away you go. So this is the sense of being stared at. And this is just kind of how I'm getting into this whole area here. So I have, as references in some of my papers, two or three papers by this guy who's a sociologist who's surveyed college students, and he's just like absolutely dismayed and bummed out to find out that 25% of college students believe that something comes out of your eyes and is involved in vision. And he says, this is horrible. We've got to educate these people better. Can you believe it? Anybody still believes that primitive stuff? And we know scientifically that nothing comes out of your eyes whatsoever. But the ancient Greeks thought that, but we can't fault them because that was thousands of years ago. Well, so this is a common human experience, a sense of being stared at. And it just gets completely squashed down, dismissed, ridiculed by conventional Western scientists. It's completely impossible. Nothing comes out of your eyes. So I just thought to myself, okay, well, I don't buy everything these guys say to start with. So I've had this experience. It sure seems real. It doesn't happen that often. But when it does happen, it doesn't seem like a coincidence. So I'm going to not dismiss it, and I'm going to think seriously about it. And I kind of, you know, read stuff, and then I was busy with medical school and et cetera. And now, last 10 or so years, I've gotten back to it. And so then I thought to myself, well, okay, what kind of energy could this be? So it's like some sort of chi energy, or it's the human aura, or it's this human spirit, or it's the life force. But if I call it any of those things, that doesn't lead me anywhere on the medical scientific side. So then, and there's a whole philosophical background to this, but basically I decided, well, when we're actually measuring the mind scientifically, what do we measure? Well, we can measure the brain, and we can take it out and weigh it and cut it up. But when we're measuring the mind, basically we do an EEG, which is measuring the brain waves that come out through your skull. So then I decide, well, why don't I just make the mind, the life force, the chi energy, the human spirit, and the electrical magnetic field of the body be the same thing? We have the spiritual language and philosophical language, experiential language, and then we have our scientific vocabulary for studying it scientifically. When we're studying it scientifically, we go, well, we don't talk about that spiritual stuff. We just measure the electromagnetic field. But it's really just different approaches and different languages for the same thing. And so then once I decide on that strategy, then I said to myself, well, wait a minute. So if there's energy coming out through your skull, and we put an electrode on your skull, and we measure it, and that's mainstream science, those same brain waves that are coming through your skull to get to the electrode have to be coming out your eye. And since they don't have to go through your skull, maybe they're stronger. So maybe the energy that is the foundation for the sense of being stared at is nothing mystical. It's just a sort of collimated beam of brain waves coming out through your eyes. And it comes out as a beam because it's a little bit stronger than the general field that goes through your skull, because it doesn't have to get through your skull. Maybe because the optic nerve is right there, which is like this huge electrical cable right there. Maybe because of the shape of the skull, and maybe because of conscious focusing and attention, gives this kind of beam-like quality to the brain waves that are coming out of your eye. And so if that's true, then should be able to design an electrode to pick them up, which I then very cheaply and quite simply with help from some contractors ended up with this electrode that I put inside some goggles. So it's just basically a ski mask, ski goggles, I mean. And so on the outside of the lens of the ski goggles, I put copper mesh and tin foil to sort of electromagnetically insulate the space. Inside the goggles, in front of my eye, but not touching my eye or my eyelashes, is this high impedance electrode, which is more sensitive than the average electrode. And then at the same time, I've got normal EEG electrodes all over my head. And this guy is taking my EEG. And lo and behold, the signal that's coming out through my eyes, that's being picked up by an electrode that's not touching my body, follows exactly the same pattern in the tracings as the electrodes on my forehead. If I blink, if the waves just change kind of naturally, they become either higher or lower frequency for a short period of time, you can see just at a glance, this is obviously physiological brain waves, basically with the same patterns as the ones picked up coming out of my forehead, just by a normal conventional EEG, which is in these papers. So I've basically proven scientifically that you can take a normal EEG by measuring the energy that comes out of your eyes with no physical contact with your body. And there's engineers in England who I reference in the papers who are taking an EKG from 3 feet away now, with no physical contact with the body. And the basic physics of this is this very low frequency electromagnetic radiation, like 0 to 40 hertz, which means 0 to 40 cycles per second, which is the level we measure brainwaves at. Those signals propagate out into the environment literally for thousands of kilometers without dropping off, whereas higher frequency signals drop off in intensity very quickly. So these are all physics facts. So now I'm kind of stalled out for lack of funding right now, but I'm at the point where we kind of already knew, but I've just pointed it out. the electromagnetic field of the body doesn't just stop at your skin. It's propagated out into the world for a scientific fact. And we can, I mean, this is like very primitive stage of development. We've got these hokey little electrodes that could pick these things up. Once we get the software really, really, really sensitive, and we get the electrode, the hardware, really well developed, and we get like noise reduction and all this other stuff going on, we're going to be able to pick up these signals 10, 20, 50, 100, 200 feet away. And so the theory now is that the sense of being stared at is actually a real phenomenon, but it's the signal's so weak you only sometimes pick it up, and a lot of times it's kind of lost in the noise. But if we go back in evolution hundreds of thousands or millions of years, this is the interaction between the predator and the prey. So if a gazelle can sense the focused stare of the lion when the lion's like a couple hundred yards away staring at him, and gets this sense of being ill at ease, danger, doesn't really know what's going on, but takes off, well, that gazelle is going to survive better than the one who doesn't pick up the stare at all. So since it's going to survive better, than normal evolution, mutation, selection is going to, you know, favor that gene and favor that skill, and it's going to be preserved across evolution. So then we go forward in time to the human race, and we have evil eye sickness, which is clearly superstition. But the idea is, okay, Western science just completely throws that out. You can't cast a spell on somebody by staring at them. All the rituals that go with that, all the like the witches who do it and counter witches who fight it, it's all just, it's interesting to anthropologists, but there's no real physical reality to it. It's just primitive superstition. So we throw the whole thing out. But so what I'm saying is, no, wait a minute. In all kinds of different traditional beliefs about chi energy, spirits, you know, telepathy, all kinds of things, there could be a core physiological reality. And then we've wrapped all this kind of cultural tradition and superstition around it. So what do we already know the human body can do? We already know that the human body does detect, capture photons, electromagnetic radiation, and use them to drive biological processes. This is a known fact. So there, the human body has receptors for electromagnetic radiation that it uses to drive biological processes. These biological processes include vision, seeing things, getting a suntan. So there's receptors in your skin that capture the photons and use it to drive the synthesis of melanin. Synthesizing vitamin D in your skin, which everybody agrees sunlight is essential for synthesizing vitamin D. And the entire biosphere has the foundation of plants capturing photons and using them to synthesize chlorophyll. I mean, it's the whole chlorophyll, you know, sugar metabolism pathway. So the entire biosphere depends on living things capturing photons with receptors that detect them. So we already know there are receptors for photons in the human body. So it's not much of a jump to say, well, one of the forms of electromagnetic radiation that the body can detect is brain waves coming out of somebody's eye. So now what we have is a scientific theory with a stated mechanism that actually can be investigated scientifically. And so then what you would want to do is develop a little gun, which is not a warfare type gun, that emits radiation that's got the same amplitude frequency as the energy coming out of your eye that I've already measured, that I've already published in peer-reviewed journals. And then you would want this gun to be able to crank up the amplitude or the intensity of the signal. So if you did it, you know, in a certain way, you basically have a laser and you could cut through steel. But if you had a signal that was nowhere near that strong and not quite that coordinated, then it would be like the energy that comes out of your eyes. It'd just be a lot more intense. And anybody could feel it 100% of the time if you shot the gun at the back of their neck. And if you crank it up too far, you'd actually burn a hole in their skin. So then now we know that people can detect this. And then what we want to do is turn the intensity down, 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 and find out, you know, if we study 100 people, where does the signal start to become undetectable? What's the threshold? And then we want to compare that threshold to the intensity of the signal that comes out through your eyes. And then we want to find, okay, there's going to be some people who are better at detecting this than other people. And who are the most sensitive people? And then we want to go inside an electromagnetically insulated room where there's no, all the background noise is cut out. And we live in a sea of background noise in the city. So the eye signal is just totally swamped out in the natural environment. But if you insulate the room, now you're back in the electromagnetic conditions of a million years ago. You can find out where the threshold is using this gun. You can start doing experiments where the person guesses the person not behind me is or is not staring at me, see what their hit rate is. Then you can start training people to have a better hit rate, be more sensitive. We just turned the stupid superstition that everybody threw out into a proven scientific fact, you know, if we are able to walk down all those steps.
That is truly fascinating research, Dr. Colin Ross. And it sounds like we could have a whole other show on this whole other, you know, chapter of your work. It's very, it's sort of reminiscent of the whole quantum entanglement to me. It's part of that whole process. And I'm really excited to see where you go with this. I'm sorry to hear about the research stall, but I sure understand that. You know, just like earlier when you were talking about your research into the early work in the 50s and 40s and having to go through, actually physically go through documents and stuff. And I can completely relate to that because of my own research into things Freemasonic and esoteric and the occult and fraternal orders. It's all actual physical documents. There's not a lot of digital databasing going on in the period that I'm looking at. But go ahead.
You can't apply to the Scottish Rite Foundation for a grant very easily.
No, I don't think they'd really want to. They'd love to have me work with them, but not on the material I want to work with, that's for sure.
Right.
But anyways, Dr. Ross, we pretty much reached the end of our time together, and I wanted to thank you so much for taking the time and consideration to review the material that you have gathered, and please keep us informed on the research. We'd love to have you come back on, especially any new developments, but I wanted to give you an opportunity. I know we've already directed folks to the rossinst.com site. Is there any other places you'd like to direct people's attention who are listening to continue to stay updated on all of your goings on?
Yeah, I have several websites, but they're all linked together. So that's like the main one that deals with psychiatry. There's a button on that site to Ross Energy Systems, or you can just go directly to rossenergysystems.com. And there's a link to my bookstore, which is my publishing company called Manitou Communications. And all my books are available there, and they're also available on Amazon.
Excellent. Well, thank you again, and I think that we've covered a lot of bases on this conversation, and I'm glad that we were able to unpack the material that you have gathered, and thank you for your hard and tedious work in these areas, because I think you've done a lot of good bringing clarity to some very important issues and to bring truth and clarity to what's already unfolded, things that have already transpired, and what continues to happen today.
Well, thanks for having me, and again, happy birthday. And I'd be happy to come back.
Excellent. Well, we'll keep you in the loop, and please keep us in the loop as well. And on that note, say goodnight, Mater X.
Good night, Mater X.
All right. Thank you again, sir. Have a great weekend.
Yeah, same to you.
Thank you.